Taking a look at animal behavior today with Patricia McConnell. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Patricia has been with us many, many, many times on the program. Back again. She's from Black Earth, as many of you know, an ethologist, PhD, certified applied animal behaviorist. And she is the behavior columnist for Bark magazine.
You got it right.
Consulting editor for the Journal of Comparative Psychology, adjunct associate professor in zoology at the UW-Madison, and has authored, is it 13 now?
I think it's 13. I start losing track sometimes. But
13 books on training and behavior, including the Puppy Primer or Puppy Primer, if you want, whichever. You say potato, I say potato.
Yeah, you know, I don't really care either way. You know, either way, puppy primer is like getting them ready, you know, priming them for their happy adult life. Or puppy primer is like, you know, that sort of old-fashioned little training book kind of thing. So,
you know, like primer.
I can go either way.
Well, that's what you do in this book, isn't it? Kind of prime those puppies and prime those humans.
Yeah, you got it. You nailed it right there, Larry. It's, you know, so much of training a dog is about training ourselves. And we didn't come hardwired.
No.
You know, we didn't have a software program implanted to know how to train dogs. And the thing is that once you know how to do it, you know, raising a puppy is always a lot of work. There is no way around it. But once you, one, know how to do it, and two, know what is realistic to expect at what age, because that's one of the biggest problems I see, Larry, and we talk about it in this book a lot, about what to expect and what's normal and what's not. And so many people are a tad unrealistic in their expectations.
My 10-week-old puppy should be able to...
Yeah. Oh, I'll get calls of people who have a 9-10-week-old puppy and say he's not house trained yet. It's like, yeah. And did you call with a problem?
But in your book, you tell people how to deal with these things and when it's appropriate to train and what to expect.
We do. And, you know, one of the things that's so important to me about this book is that it's updated in such a way, it's updated and expanded in such a way to help people understand and know how to use practically how to use positive reinforcement without just like giving your dog a cookie because they're cute.
Yeah,
you know, it's
sure.
Not spoiling your dog. It's learning how to influence their behavior to get them to do what you want. And it explains how this whole concept of dominance is often so misunderstood and misused. You know, dogs, dominance has nothing to do with whether your dog comes when you call or whether your dog jumps up on visitors. That has nothing to do with social status, nothing. And so if you learn how to use positive reinforcement the right way,
yes.
So you don't always have to have a cookie in your pocket, and if you understand sort of proper expectations again, it is so much fun to raise a puppy, and you do it in such a way that you have a happy dog who loves you rather than is afraid of you, and that's one of the big concerns.
Well, many callers online all ready to talk with you. In fact, every one of our lines is filled. And I didn't give the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. And, well, let's take a call. How about Betsy in River Falls? Betsy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
I am a hospice volunteer, and some of the patients that I have dogs. And I've noticed that about 2 weeks before the patient dies, the dogs will sit at their owner's feet, at the dying person's feet. And when I've been driving out in the country, I've noticed sometimes I'll drive past a house and the dog will be standing and then it will sit and watch me drive by. What do we think dogs think sitting is for?
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to ask something different.
Yeah, I did too.
Oh.
What do we think dogs think sitting is for? I don't know that they think it's for anything. You know, I don't know that they strategically think it through that way, but I suspect that dogs often sit when they're trying to sort something out. And I'll see Willie, for example, my border collie, if he's unsure what to do with sheep, rather than being in that stalking posture, standing up or lying down, sort of clapped down to the ground, he'll sit with this sort of like, I don't know. So I think so much of sitting is because we've taught it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, dogs sit, I think, much more frequently than they would if they hadn't been taught and reinforced for sitting a lot. You know, we seem to love it when dogs sit. So I don't know. It's actually a really good question.
I thought she was going to ask about an article that I read recently about a doctor who worked in a nursing home.
Yes, in New England.
And they had the dog would spend time with those people who were going to be dying.
The dog was the angel of death. And basically, I don't think a lot of people would have believed this story, except it was written by the physician who was in charge of the facility.
And who was very...
Who had a lot of cred, basically. Not that all physicians always make all sense in the world, but the guy obviously has a lot of credibility and was very thoughtful about this. And it appears that there was almost a perfect correlation between this dog going and lying in the bed of, or sitting at the base of the bed, within 24 to 36 hours of somebody actually passing away. So is there, I thought your question was going to be, what are the dogs sensing? You know, how do the dogs
know?
Yeah,
how do they sense that?
All I know is that when it's about to happen, they pay close attention to everything that goes on, and they sometimes, I'm only there for 2 hours in a week, but they will absolutely pay close attention to every sound. Their ears are perked. They're just paying really close attention, and I have a feeling that if anyone did anything untoward at all, they would. It's like they're defending their master in a way that they probably never had to before, and it just gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, and me too. And it brings up so many interesting questions. One is, do dogs have a concept of death? Because it's a very complicated concept that requires thinking into the future. You know, young children don't have a concept of death, you know?
No.
Daddy died, when's he coming back? I mean, it's one of the hardest things about having really young children whose one of their parents dies. They don't get it. So that brings up a really interesting question. I talk about that, actually, Larry, and For the Love of a Dog, that book about emotions.
Yes, you do.
But I have no definitive answer, just more questions.
Thank you so much for calling, Betsy. Appreciate it. Kim in River Falls, let's go to you next. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I think you're the person to talk to, Sandy. I have a border collie, I think. We got it from the Humane Society, and it's a mix of something, but it seems like border collie. But she runs up behind me whenever we're playing fetch, and she just bangs into the back of my legs with whatever she happens to have. And one day when we were walking her, I had her off leash, and she just came flying by me, hit me in the back of my legs, and put me face down on the street.
Ooh.
How do I stop her from doing that?
Ooh. First of all, I'm Patricia. I'm not Sandy.
Oh, I was thinking, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, I knew who you were. I'm sorry.
Oh, but it's okay. But I love Sandy, and I listen to her whenever I can. So I consider that a compliment.
Oh, go ahead.
But if I was going to say something stupid, I thought I should, you know, give Sandy a break so Dr. Sawchuk didn't get in trouble for something stupid that I said. But I'll tell you, I am glad you called, because this is not good. I mean, I've had clients who had knees put out and legs broken. This is absolutely not good. And I, you know, normally I just talk about positive reinforcement, because punishment can lead to so many problems. But I have to tell you, if this has happened to me before, and when it happened to me, here's what I did. I came up spluttering. I did not touch the dog, but I came up with a very low, don't get loud and shrieky, which is easy to do if you're an angry female, frankly. keep your voice as low as you can. But basically, I came up and said, and I'm going to do it quietly, but I wasn't quiet. I said, "What did you do?" And I looked at him with just tremendous force. I did not touch this dog, but I walked toward him, sort of backing him up, looking right at him like, "What did you do?" And then lie down, stay there. I mean, I was mad.
Sure.
You know, and I wanted the dog to know I was mad without feeling like I was going to hurt him, because I didn't, you know, because I didn't want to do that. So you don't have to touch a dog to use punishment, to use a kind of a correction. And in something this serious, I think your border collie, you know, one of the problems with these herding dogs is they love to push things around. And they need to learn right off the bat is you don't push people around like that. So, but besides this spluttering wet hen routine that I suggest you do, and this is a chance to be an actress, by the way, this is a chance to get all of your acting chops out, you know, so like, this is your big chance. But besides that, I want you to keep your eye on that dog all the time. And before he, she gets to you, I want you to stop him with a real friendly, polite thing like, sit, good dog, where's your toy? So constantly teach them what you do want them to do. They're running at you. You want them to stop, slow down, and then go get a toy and redirect. So teach them what you do want and be a spluttering wet hen when when they do what you don't want.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Ryder in Blue Mounds, we are on to you. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. So I sometimes think I could spend days talking to Patricia about cat behavior. But right now I have my main question is about dominance and grooming. I have one cat who gets her way all the time. And how she does it, say if some other cat's on a chair that she wants to sit on, she just jumps up and starts grooming the other cat, and inevitably the other cat leaves. Although sometimes they'll do it, well, they'll be willing to share the space, but she doesn't ever start a fight. She just gets up there and grooms the other cat. And I'm just wondering what Patricia's thoughts might be on that type of behavior.
I love this story. And it's such an important point. I'm really, really grateful that you brought this up. There's actually a hot discussion on my blog right now about dominance and animals. We talk mostly about dogs, but it still relates to cats and what it is and what it isn't and is it relevant. And so here's one of the points that I've been making about this, which is that there are many, many ways to get what you want. You know, having a lot of social status might get you the best table in a restaurant, but you can always slip the maitre d' $100, you know, or $500 or whatever. Or you can be so obnoxious that that they seat you to get rid of you, right? So I had a dog who most people would call extremely submissive. I mean, she was flat on her belly. She was lip-licking and tongue-kissing, and her little tail was always down, and she was always doing this little silly little goofy grin, you know. She was just so submissive to other dogs. But she took a bone away from Queen Tulip, my huge Great Pyrenees, who ruled the roost completely. And Tulip did it almost in the same way that your cat did. Pippi did it almost the same way that your cat did. Pip would lie down like 10 feet away from Tulip, and she'd start displaying these signs of appeasement. And her little tail would thump, and she'd be over on her side, and her head would be down, and she'd get this little submissive grin on her face. And she'd sort of unch her way over to Tulip and then start licking Tulip's face. And Tulip would like, ooh, she'd close her eyes and turn her head away like, ooh, ooh, ooh. And finally Tulip would get up and walk away, and Pippi got the bone. So that's not dominance. That's just smart. And again, it's a great reminder that there are a lot of ways to get what you want, and one is having a lot of social status, and the other is to be brilliant.
Thanks, Ryder, for calling. Appreciate it. Sally in Sun Prairie, on to you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was hoping you could give my husband and I some tips. We adopted a dog, it's actually about a year now, from the Humane Society here in town. He had been transferred from a facility farther north. He was diagnosed as a shy dog when we got him. And he's gotten a lot better, but he's got a lot of stress-related issues, and we don't know how to help him overcome those.
Give me an example. Tell me what's going on.
One thing he'll do, well, he doesn't really come to us if we call him. He'll kind of slink, and we've tried working with him by giving him, like, a little ice cream on our finger to try to get him to come to us. And he has a blanket we keep in a closet, and sometimes he'll just go in there and start digging, like he's just relieving the stress.
Yeah.
And he also has, when we do leave the house, inappropriate peeing, and we think that's stress-related also. So we don't know what else we can do to kind of help him overcome this.
Sure, yeah. And so I'm so glad you called, because there are lots of things you can do, and that regrettably sometimes is a sad consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of dogs who have not been brought up correctly.
Right, and they don't really know what his background was before he came to shelters before we finally got him. But
he probably didn't get a lot of interaction, you know, with humans. He might have been stuffed in a barn or a kennel somewhere, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Sad stuff. So one on the slinking up to you, one of the things to keep in mind is that direct face-to-face contact to dogs, and Larry knows this very, very well, is threatening. It's polite to us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, I talk about that a lot in The Other End of the Leash, about how, and in a lot of my seminars, I'm always talking about this, is how us primates, you know, we, like me and Larry, are looking right at each other right now. We're smiling at each other, you know, and that's really friendly. But in dog society, that's rude and threatening. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways to avoid that slinking is for you to turn your body away. So keep your body sideways, you know, keep your feet pointed 45 degrees away from the dog. Keep your head turned. Have your body lean back a little bit. Throw food towards him. Let him come to you. Don't you go to him.
Okay.
So all those things can help tremendously. And then just sort of throw the food closer and closer. I'm just repeating myself. Anyway, so all those things are really important. Mm-hmm. And so that's one. Digging in the blanket, oh, let him just haul at it. I mean, that's just a great way for him to relieve stress, you know. He might be looking for something cooler. That's often why dogs are digging. And if he lived outside a lot, he might actually be a little warm.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
That's something that could be going on. In terms of urinating in the house, here's what we don't know. This could be he's just not house trained. He probably was brought up in a kennel where he went to the bathroom where he lived. Mm-hmm. So that could be part of it. Is he loose in the house?
He is. We're usually home with him. Really, the only time he does it is when we leave. We'll come home and we'll find it. And we did have a urinary test, and everything is normal.
Good for you.
And so I just think it's stress.
It well
I
could
really
be.
Do.
Yeah, I think you're right. How long have you had him?
Well, we've had him almost a year, close to a year.
Okay.
You know, and he doesn't tell us when he has to go out, but we have another dog who always does, so we just always take them out together. So he's never really had an accident in front of us
when
that
you
we
were
can
there.
Correct them. Right. So
do you take him out right before you go and leave and make sure he urinates?
Yep.
I would, I would keep that up, and I might even give him a treat for going outside. But I think you're right.
Okay.
I think this is not so much house training, it's stress.
If he's
comfortable in a crate, sometimes dogs who are nervous alone in the house are actually more comfortable in a smaller place.
Okay.
There's less to stimulate them. There's less to overstimulate them. There's sort of less of some canine equivalent of rattling around in a big old, you know, Victorian mansion when the music starts to go.
Right.
You know? So sometimes that can help dogs, and it might at least prevent the urinating. But I would treat it like separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a little booklet on it. There are other sources. You can go on the internet for how to use counter classical conditioning to treat separation anxiety. And I don't have time to go through it here, but that's what you want to look at. And I think that might help him as well. So
good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia McConnell, our guest today as we talk about your pet's behavior. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with Patricia McConnell as we talk about your pet's behavior and animal behavior in general. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. You can even go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and post something there. In fact, we have a question from someone on the Facebook page who just wrote that in a little bit ago. She has an American wire-haired pointing griffin, about 4 months old, easy to train, wonderful to have around, doesn't shed, in capital letters. And
important to some people, right?
My only real question with him now is how Wolf can tell us when he needs to go out. He only has accidents rarely, but I wish he could tell us in no uncertain terms when he needs to go outside for this purpose. Going
now,
along with the earlier call.
Larry knows my answer to this question. Larry, you start and I'll pick it up.
No, you go ahead. I'm embarrassed.
He's chicken it out. Okay, so here's my answer, and you might not like it, but here's my answer.
I know.
Don't do it. Do not teach your dog. I can easily teach you how to teach your dog to tell you when to go out. You
put
a bell. Put a bell beside a door. Ring it yourself at first. Every time you open the door, take your dog out to potty, and then put a little food on the bell so the dog learns to nudge the bell. And then when he nudges it, you open the door, take him out to potty. But here's the problem. Your dog's going to ring the bell constantly. The worst is to teach him to bark to you. I can't tell you the number of clients I taught my dog to bark, and now he won't stop barking. please teach me how to teach my dog to stop barking now. Here's why I don't teach dogs to tell me when they need to go outside. Because dogs don't seem to get that the issue is about going potty. If they have any brain in their head at all, they're going to get like, oh, if I ring the bell, I can interrupt my human from watching her television show or eating her dinner, and she'll open the door for me and take me outside, and then I can go chase squirrels. And if you have a griffin especially, there are mice out there, there are voles, there are rabbits, there are all kinds of wonderful things out there. So what I suggest, and this is what I do, is basically it's my responsibility to take my dog out often enough. When they're young, that needs to be a lot more often.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tell you, there are times that my dog, Willie, will come up to me, and I'm doing something, and he'll sort of come up and like solicit what seems like attention, and then he'll come up again and solicit it, and I'll go like, oh, I think he's trying to tell me he needs to go potty. But mostly, I just take him out when I know he needs to go, or more often, because I don't want a smart dog, and griffins are perfectly smart. I don't mm-hmm. want a smart, active dog who loves the outdoors to learn that they can make a noise to get me. It's like they're training you. You know, you say sit, they sit. They go bark, you get up, you open the door. Look what I trained my human to do.
All right, so there you have it. And to, by the way, you have a face. You have a blog.
I don't have
a Facebook page now, but you have a blog.
I don't yet have a Facebook page, although it's in the works. It is in the works, but that's going to be, I don't know, a month or two from now.
Mm-hmm. But you have a real active blog.
Yeah, I have 14,000 people reading my blog now from all around the world. It's theotherendoftheleash.com. And it's, you know, one of the things I love about it, Larry, is it allows me to stay in an inquiry and a discussion with people all around the world, like the radio show used to do, about issues related to behavior training, et cetera, et cetera. And so I have some of the smartest readers. I can't tell you the comments I get on that blog. Some of them are brilliant. And can I tell you something I learned from it?
What did you learn?
So cool. Okay, briefly, when you have your sheep shorn, I have sheep.
Uh-huh.
When you have your sheep shorn, they often fight with each other afterwards, and I never knew. It's because they act like they're new sheep. They act like they've mm-hmm. never seen each other before, and they seem to be working out some kind of social hierarchy. So, and it can get really serious. I mean, they're backing up like National Geographic, you know, special rams, you know. So I was actually worried about two of them hurting each other, and they're also pregnant when they're shorn, right? So this is not good. So somebody on my blog, when I was speculating, is it because they don't recognize each other? She said, the old farmer's tale is it's because of smell. And what I was told by an old farmer was that if you put Menon's aftershave on all of them, they won't fight. And I was like, well. And my shearer said, I think it's smell. He said, there's a lot of smell in the fleece. There's a tremendous amount of odor in the fleece. It's individual. You take their fleece off, they don't smell the same. Well, I didn't have any Menon's aftershave lotion. But I had, Evelyn and Crabtree, you know.
Something or other.
Nantucket floral body spray. So my barn smelled like a whorehouse. Because I sprayed everybody with this body spray, and they didn't fight.
And they didn't fight.
They did not fight at all. How cool was that?
One of the many things you'll learn when you go to your blog.
Absolutely.
But it's not only about sheep.
It's not usually about sheep.
Oh, man. All right. And what's the address again?
It's just theotherendoftheleash.com.
Theotherendoftheleash.com. And the Facebook page for me is The Larry Mueller Show. So there you have it.
I'll have to go visit you.
Come visit.
I will.
John in Amherst Junction, we go to you. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi, Larry. Hello, Dr. McConnell. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have a question about Blitz. He's my almost 6-year-old German wire-haired pointer, and he does two what I think are pretty unusual behaviors. The first one is he parades his food bowl around after eating. Actually, he uses his little sisters now because we gave him one with a rounded edge that he can't grab. And the second behavior, which is really unusual, is that he suckles his foot, his rear foot,
oh.
and he basically suckles himself to sleep about
oh.
every night.
Oh.
And, you know, I asked the breeder that we got him from, I said, you know, could you have taken him away too early or something? And it was almost kind of offensive. I felt kind of guilty about
right.
asking that. But anyway, I was just wondering what you thought those behaviors were.
Well, that's really interesting. And this, you know, the second one, you were right to ask that. It was a perfectly
sure.
reasonable question, because that often is what you find with animals who will suck on blankets or suck on another animal. I haven't heard about a lot who use their own body. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
But it's very often that animals who do that. My lassie used to do that. And she had a mom who was just not best,
not the best mom.
Not the best mom in the world. And so she didn't, she's sort of making up for that. But it's a kind of a way of self-medicating. You know, we know that that process changes internal physiology. It changes neurohormones. It decreases stress. It might increase oxytocin. I know, I'm not positive about that.
Huh?
But there are a lot of...
That's the good stuff.
Yeah, that's the good stuff. That's the happy internal drug. It makes you all happy and warm and wussy and more trusting, as a matter of fact. So it might increase serotonin also, you know. So basically, your dog is sort of self-regulating, self-medicating. And who knows, you know, who knows how that started. If it's not hurting itself, I would let it go. But if I would watch that foot, because sometimes I've seen it on animals who were being basically nursed on by some other individual, you can end up with some medical problems. So make sure it dries, it's not wet, that it's not leading to any kind of...
Well, he injured it very seriously while hunting last fall.
Oh,
and
the plot thickens.
And he ended up, we had a large bandage on it, and we had to keep him from sucking on that bandage, because he would do it right through the bandage.
Oh, the plot thickens.
Yeah.
Because so often dogs will start licking areas because they hurt, you know?
Uh-huh.
One of the sort of jokes between vets and behaviorists is that we're always sending each other's clients back and forth who have, quote, acrylic dermatitis. They start licking on a part of their body, and they keep licking so much that they actually cause injuries. And for years, I have been sending them back to the vet saying, your animal is licking because it hurts. And vets say, it's a behavioral problem. I say, no, it's a medical problem. No, it's a behavioral problem. And it turns out I was justified, Larry. It turns out that some injuries can cause little tiny crystals, actually, between the cells of the skin that are constantly irritating and bothersome. Anyway, so it well might have happened because he was, you know, oriented towards this injured, painful foot, wanted to lick on it. That sort of started sucking, and that ended up making him feel better.
Yeah.
So he's learned to do it. So is the foot okay? Is the sucking hurting the foot at all? Can we just dismiss?
No, good. No.
Okay.
Actually, I guess you misunderstood me, because he suckled way before the injury.
Ah, I did misunderstand.
He's been suckling since he was a pup.
Okay.
All right.
Well, whatever reason, he has learned that has just makes him feel better. You know,
yeah.
Maybe he's a little arthritic or something.
Well, but Lassie did it all the time. You know,
no.
It's just is a way of sort of calming and so. But the other one, this parading around with a food bowl, that one, how cute is this? Please, please take a video. Please put it on YouTube so I can post it on my blog. Because you know, Larry can put it on Facebook. How cute is that?
Our house is kind of circular. The main floor set up, and if we allow him,
he will
circle 20, 30 times, and if eventually it just gets too annoying, we have to take
the
bowl away.
You're right. It's time. You know, it reminds, I can't tell you exactly why, but it reminds me so much of so many of the hunting breeds or the retrieving breeds who love to have something in their mouth, and they greet you with it in their mouth, just like a little kid does. You know, what's the age, Larry, you've been through this recently. What's the age where a little kid show you their toy and then you reach to take it and they pull it back?
Pull it back.
Like three or four or something?
Two, three years old.
Yeah, so they're like, look, and you look at it and you reach towards it and they pull it back like, oh, you can't have it. You know, and all these dogs who like show you like, look what I've got, but you can't take it away, you know. I think it's the same kind of joy about love of objects.
We'll send you a video.
Please do.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's say, you know, all this business about sucking on the foot. We have kitty Coco, who's a new kitty. And Coco, we thought, I think we supposedly was 11 weeks old or 12 weeks old, but we now think he was younger because
really?
He loves to lick on Renee.
Oh.
So me, he'll, you know, make a one little lick and then he's off to Renee. And
she just tastes better.
Probably. I don't know. But he will lick to the point of, you know, he would lick her
raw. Enough,
enough,
enough. Yeah, yeah.
And so we wondered if he wasn't...
Does he need with his front paws? Yeah. Yeah, who knows what happened early on. Yeah.
But I'm telling you, it can be really irritating at 3 in the morning when he jumps on the bed and starts licking.
I get that. Cats are good at those irritating 3 in the morning ventures, aren't they?
And here's one, an email from Gabrielle in Delafield. Have you ever wondered why some pooches pace before pooping? The pace before pooping.
Oh, but we could actually answer that one. There's so many things that we can't answer. But here's the best explanation. It turns out that the way dogs are designed is it's very difficult for them to move their bowels without moving around.
Oh.
So there you are.
There you are. That's why they do
it. They're just sort of getting things lined up in the right way.
And another Facebook question from the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page was, why do dogs so often go around in a circle before they sit down?
A related question. I was thinking about that one, too. A related question. And that one we do not have the answer to. There's all this speculation. The one I hear most often is that they're moving around to sort of beat the grass down, to sort of create a kind of a little sleeping area in the grasses. And that it's a remnant. It's one of those behavior that's sort of a remnant. You know, mm-hmm. of a behavior that made sense when they were sleeping in grasses. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not totally sure how satisfied I am with that. I have to tell you, because, I mean, if you look at feral dogs, if you look at free-ranging dogs, if you look at wolves, it's not like the high grass prairie is their natural habitat, you know? I mean, there are a lot of places to lie down and sleep that don't have high grass in them. So I don't think we have a clue. That's my definitive answer.
And here's an email from Patty, who has an otherwise sweet toy poodle that I've had since he was 6 weeks old, now 6 years old. A few years ago, he started becoming exceptionally aggressive, snarling and biting when I tried to groom him or remove dingleberries from his bottom. Also, if I give him a treat and then act like I'm going to take it away from him, he goes ballistic as well. What have I done wrong?
My son-in-law calls dingleberries Klingons. I always like that. So... Well, I don't know if you've done anything wrong, first of all. That's the first thing. The second thing I need to say is this is a potential serious, serious issue, right?
Yeah.
I don't want you bitten. I don't want your dog ending up in big, big trouble. Biting somebody else, getting you sued, getting you in the hospital. I don't want to be having a conversation about putting your dog down. So I would love it if you would find a qualified trainer, veterinary behaviorist, qualified behaviorist, somebody who really knows about using operant conditioning and is not just going to tell you you've got to get dominance over your dog. Because if you get in a fight with this dog, I tell you, I guarantee you, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
You know, and there are people who will fight with dogs. I mean, I've seen it done. I've seen it in person. I've seen it on television. And if you don't care about getting bitten, then... Well, yeah. Okay, but I suggest you don't do that. So the first thing I would do, besides looking to see if you can find a qualified assistant, helper, coach, is to make sure there's nothing physically wrong with your dog. So I really want you to work very closely with your veterinarian. I can't tell you how many clients' dogs I've had who became aggressive because of grooming or being touched or having their collar taken, who ended up having a serious neck problem. In some cases, they were cured by their veterinarian with Western medicine. In other cases, they went to a chiropractor and got the problem resolved. So that's something that's really important. Now, it might have nothing to do with a medical issue. And this is where the trainer behaviorist can help you. It might be that your dog is like, well, a little growl worked, you know, and so I'm just going to up the ante because all this is working. And I can have life be just the way I want it to be and not have to get groomed or touched in a way I don't want to get touched. If that's true, and even if that is the case, since there's probably some learning that's gone on anyway, what's really, really important is to, one, teach your dog what you do want. So, for example, you want to groom your dog, for example. There's nothing wrong with teaching your dog using classical counter conditioning that it's actually sort of fun to have your paw picked up or to have your tail touched. So you do it really slowly. You touch a paw, you give a treat. You touch a paw, you give a treat. You touch a paw, you give a treat. You do that like 25 times in a row. And then you quit there. You don't actually do any real grooming. You just have one little session where you sort of ease your way into it. And then you gradually work your way closer and closer to what you want. Now, if your dog has grooming that he really, really needs right away, this is why I love muzzles. I love muzzles. And with a dog like this, there is nothing wrong with teaching them that muzzles aren't so bad either. You put a treat in the muzzle, let your dog get it, get them used to putting their nose in themselves, and then eventually, while they're eating a treat somebody else is holding, you attach the muzzle behind their ears. So you can do what you need to do safely. But this does not have to be happening, okay?
Yeah.
I can't fix it right now. I mean, we could spend the next 45 minutes on it. I could do my best. but that probably wouldn't suit the other callers. So this is fixable, but you need the right help. And don't just keep doing what you're doing because it's going to get you hurt.
Let's turn to Carolyn next in Oshkosh. Carolyn, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, there's so many stories I could share after listening to the majority of the show that other pet owners have had, but the one that I called about was the woman who talked about death angels, pets, and service pets.
Yes.
I had some friends that were doing 12-hour shift work and wanted a puppy, so I had been watching their babysitting for their dog and got a call from Milwaukee that my grandmother was on her last days or last hours and that we needed to get down there. Well, having this 10-week-old puppy, I needed to take him with me because he was not housebroken and that would have been
sure.
too long of a time.
Yeah.
So I took him with me. The nursing home said absolutely I could bring him in, and my grandmother had always been a huge dog lover. She had been basically either sleeping or going in and out of consciousness for a couple of days and hadn't been lucid for about a year. And when I came in with this puppy, she woke up. She said hello to me. She played with the puppy. She was totally lucid, in the best of spirits. Looked at me and said she wasn't afraid. And she said, I'm tired now. And I said, well, we'll stay here till you fall back to sleep. And the dog just laid next to her. Now, this is a 10-week-old puppy.
Wow.
Who hadn't been out for a little run or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
He was absolutely perfect during that time. And I thought, you know, that it was odd because he's such a shyster the majority of, of the time. And I thought, really wanted to share that story with all
That's
of you.
That's a wonderful story, and I'm so glad you shared it. And you know, one comment about what was going on with your grandmother is, you know, what was going on with your dog? I don't know, but we know a lot more now about the biology of why your grandmother woke up and was so responsive. It turns out that the biology of the human-animal bond is becoming better understood and is profoundly important. I was just actually doing grant reviews for the National Institute of Health, for the National Institute of Child Health and Development, related to the human-animal bond and what we're starting to understand about some of this biology. And here's one of the things we know already, is that when people are petting an animal, their levels of oxytocin double. Okay, oxytocin is like the wonder drug. Oxytocin turns off the HPA axis, which is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is the whole area of your brain and body that's related to stress and the production of cortisol and creates that feeling of stress and often distress that's bad on the immune system. So oxytocin boosts the immune system, increases feelings of well-being, decreases pain. This is another study. Actually, decreases the sensation of pain. People who had pet therapy used half the amount of pain medication after a joint replacement surgery than people who did not. So what happened is just the presence of this animal, it's way beyond this, like, oh, we all love dogs. It's that there's really rigorous biology that explains this. And this is why progressive nursing homes are starting to look more and more carefully about using animals in animal-assisted therapy and animal-assisted activities, because it can have a profound effect on the well-being of their patients. So that's just a beautiful example of some really cool biology and a really gorgeous story.
Thank you, Carolyn, for sharing that with us. Appreciate it very much. Talking today with Patricia McConnell about, we talked a little bit about her new book. It's actually the second edition of her best-selling book, Puppy Primer, Positive and Effective Training Tips. And, of course, we're answering your questions as well. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation as we talk about pet behavior with Patricia McConnell, join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And Kathy in La Crosse up next, so let's go to her. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We are going on a two-week vacation this summer, and our dog has problems with separation anxiety when we're gone. And we're wondering what's the best way we can do to prepare him. He doesn't eat when we're out of town, even for a weekend, leaving him with family members. Kids, our own kids, he still won't eat, and just his list and things like that. Do you have any suggestions to make it easier on him?
Oh, dear. So even if he stays in the same house, is he that bad?
He won't eat.
Oh,
boy.
The dog who loved too much.
And the last time we went on a vacation, when we came back, he was just neurotic, and it was awful. So we're hoping to...
Is he alone during the day? Or somebody home with him all the time? Is he never alone except when you go?
Most of the time there's someone there coming or going. So.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would try. I'm hoping you have a lot of time in between now and your vacation, because this, you know, this is not a sustainable kind of dependency.
Right.
Yeah, I really feel for you. So here's what I would do. I would treat this like separation anxiety. You know, some dogs can't stand being left alone. But anybody will do, you know.
Yeah.
You could send anybody over. But other dogs, it's all about their human, and that's the only thing that will make them feel better. And clearly this is your dog. So I would treat this like separation anxiety. And so here's what you want to start doing is, first of all, find the food that your dog loves more than anything in the whole world. So maybe chicken. You know, we're talking real chicken here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what I want you to do is I want your dog to start getting used to eating that chicken out of a hollow toy when you go away so that nobody's in the house for like 5 minutes. So you're going to like go out of your way to say, let's see, we're going to both walk to the mailbox. We don't have to both go to the mailbox, but we're both going to go to the mailbox and leave the house empty with our dog, have a like a big Kong or some hollow toy that's stuffed with real chicken in it. Put it down before you go, walk to the mailbox, go back, and I want you to see if that chicken was eaten. You know, was any food at all eaten out of that Kong? If your dog didn't touch it and sat at the window and watched you, then you're going to need to back up even more, and you're going to need to start teaching your dog that it's fun to have you put on your coat and pick up your keys. Such that, and again, you're going to have to do this such that there's nobody left at home. So it's going to be a little bit harder because you're going to have to coordinate this with the two of you.
Well, he'll be home for 6-7 hours by himself. It's just the, he knows when the suitcase goes out the door.
He knows
when we're getting ready in the morning if you're curling it. He knows.
Okay, good. And there we go. Because here's the key. He knows, and there's no question that dogs learn suitcases. Mine know suitcases.
Yes.
There's no question.
Cats do as well.
I've had plenty of clients. Sounds like Larry's cat knows suitcases. So what basically with this conditioning procedure is you find the trigger. What is the trigger that starts to get my dog upset? And so you know it's suitcases. So one, I want you to get your suitcases out and open with some things in them, and I want them to be open all the time. Just put them out somewhere. And go back and forth, put things in them, take things out of them, so that basically your dog habituates to suitcases being out. And then you can move your way up to actually taking your suitcase and walking outside the door with a suitcase. But again, now he's going to have this
Kong
stuff with things. Go go online and find booklets on using classical conditioning for treating separation anxiety and use those kind of processes. But the good news is you've got a lot of time, I think, because it's only early April, so you've got a lot of time to start working on this before you go away. You're going to need about 2 months or so. So hopefully you've got that. And is this going to make your dog happy you're gone? No, but hopefully he'll at least be eating. You don't have to be worrying about him. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Dan in Partyville, we're on to you. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for the show.
Sure.
My wife and I have two rescue dogs we got from the German Shepherd Rescue. One's a German Shepherd Collie, one's a German Shepherd Lab. They're both neutered. I think the Lab, Apollo, I don't think he ever really learned how to play, because if we're, you know, playing a little bit in the house with a ball or out in the yard, he seems confused and he'll try to hump Micah. Of course, Micah doesn't like that, and he snaps. He doesn't get him. It's just a warning, but you can tell when Apollo's motor gets going at night, his tail will wag, he'll lick Micah's flues, and then he'll try to hump, even if they're not playing sometimes. Can we break him of that? Is it an insecurity problem?
Well, it could be. It could be several things. It could be just like goofy adolescent. How old do we have any idea?
Apollo's 5, I believe.
Okay. So that's no excuse.
No excuse.
Although, you know, some dogs, just like some people, they're just sort of stuck.
Never grow up.
You know, it's like all those sort of guy movies, you know.
He's got a very somber attitude, Apollo does. He's not real playful. He's not really standoffish, but I've got a big rubber bone that we go out in the field that I have fenced off behind the house, and I'll play frisbee with Micah. Apollo will chase Micah
but not the toy.
Yeah. And if I go in the house, Apollo will lay down and chew on the bone, and Micah wants to play.
Right. You know, some dogs just never start playing with objects, and partly sometimes it's because of a developmental neglect, basically. There appears to be a kind of a object window, and if dogs don't play with objects during a certain period of development in the first year, it can be really hard to teach them to play with objects. It can take up to a year of like a lot of work. If you don't need to, then, you know, why bother? But so back to the humping. Probably it could be one of two things. It's either about social status, because mounting is often used as a way of sort of maintaining or getting social status, the D word. Or, you know, some dogs just do it when they get excited. You know, they're another animal's playing and they're getting all revved up and they sort of don't know what to do with themselves because they haven't learned how to play. So they just have all this energy, they don't know what to do with it, and then there they are.
He never displays the chin over that I expect in a dominant dog.
Good observation.
He doesn't do that.
I think it might just be about just sort of generic free-floating stimulation, which he has nothing else to do with. Does your other dog mind it very much?
Yeah, he doesn't like it.
Okay.
He doesn't like it. A couple of years ago, we took him to in Portage, there's a dog trainer up there. I didn't like the way he did it because he would let all the dogs run around all together for a while. And of course, Apollo didn't know what to do, and he chased Micah all over trying to hump him when there's, you know, 15 other dogs out there.
No, that's not good. I wouldn't like that situation either. I don't blame you for not going back there. But here's what I would do. I would work with Apollo separately such that you have really great vocal control over him. So get a really good dog training book that uses positive reinforcement and teach him a couple of things. Just have him master a few things such that he'll do it when he's really excited. So teach him to come to you. Teach him, you can teach no if you do it in a really fun way. Just teach it like a circus trick. You can, you know, don't just yell no and think they're going to stop and then get louder, which is what most people do. But teach him a cue that is incompatible with the problem. You know, so if he's coming to you, he can't be humping the other dog. If he's sitting, he can't be humping the other dog. If he's doing high five, you know, so teach him some cue that he's mastered. So no matter how excited he is, you can say it. And when he starts to do it to the other dog, I just want you to be like, you know, that'll do, or sit, or or look stupid or roll over or take a bow. You might teach him a play bow, which is a very nice signal that relaxes other dogs. It relaxes him. It gives him something to do with his energy. I love teaching dogs play bows whenever there's issues between two dogs. So you might want to use that one. So I say, take a bow. So if it was my dog, I might go like, no, take a bow. So I'd be saying, no, don't do that. Now do this. So give that a try.
Give that a shot.
Want to recommend a book?
Yeah, recommend your book.
Well,
I've got a couple of yours, but I can't remember what they are.
I'm hesitating here. Probably the best book for you is Family Friendly Dog Training. It uses positive reinforcement, but it focuses not on just using it to spoil your dog, but on how to use it to influence behavior and how to work your way up to master something. So you might want to try that one. You can get it on my website.
And your website is?
Just my name, just patriciamcconnell.com.
PatriciaMcConnell.com. And Patricia McConnell will, not .com, Patricia McConnell will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about your pet's behavior with Patricia McConnell, author of many books, including The Puppy Primer. That's a bestseller, and it's now in its second edition. Updated, expanded. I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Puppy Primer, Positive and Effective Training Tips. So we're really pleased to have her here today. And you know, Patricia, earlier in the show, we were talking about what we said was a dog and knows about a dog knowing a person is dying. And there was a doctor in New England who had written about this. But it turns out, as Ruth from Watertown reminds
us. An alert listener. Thank you, Ruth. Thank you.
It was a cat, not a dog.
We were so wrong.
The book is Making Rounds with Oscar by David Dosa.
MD.
And the nursing home is the Steer Nursing Home in Rhode Island. And it is a great read.
And so thank you, listener. Larry and I stand corrected for being doggist.
But cats apparently can do this as well.
Absolutely.
Tammy and Glidden, it is your turn. Hi, Tammy.
Yeah, hi. I got one question, and I also can fix a dilemma that you had.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Why dogs circle?
Oh, you know the answer.
Yeah, because I work for the International Wolf Center. The reason why they do it is called bedding. It's like cats knead before they lay down.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs go round and round till they find out it's soft enough or cool enough, and then they lay down.
Well, that's the theory.
Even in a bed, that's what they do no matter what.
Right.
It's called bedding.
Right. Yeah, no, and I totally believe that. I know that's the term, but I still am not convinced that any of us really know. I mean, that's a good hypothetical reason. Is there, you know, they're testing something about, is this a good place to lie, you know? But why do they need to circle to do that? Why would they? I mean,
they always do it to cool off the area.
It cools off the area.
Yeah.
Now, why would
it's like cats need to soften. Hmm. Dogs want it cooler.
Well, cats need to stimulate milk production.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that's very interesting. Thank you for that input from the Wolf Center. What a great experience that must have been.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
Well, I've been studying wolves for over 20 years.
Very cool. But you have another question.
Yes, I do. Okay, I got a dog. He's 4 years old. He's a wolf chow mix. And doesn't matter who's in the house. I got two little boys and my husband. And no matter when I leave, he whines, yelps constantly. And then when I get back, it's like so loud. But it's only me. It doesn't matter if I just, you know, if he's out in the yard for a little while, that's fine. But if I walk around the, you know, the house, he just goes nuts.
Because you're leaving.
It's just me.
Right.
Nobody else.
Yeah.
If they come and go, it doesn't bother him.
So did you say this was a wolf chow mix?
Yeah.
Did I hear that right?
Yes.
Okay.
I was there when he was born, and I've had him since.
Okay. Well, you know, it's not uncommon for dogs to become just obsessively, you know, dependent upon one individual. You know, my Lassie, who died in January, She was always the one who always followed me. You know, if there was a bunch of us and I went one way and Jim went the other, she would always follow me.
Yeah, that's Reggie.
Always broke my heart to take her to a vet clinic, you know, and have them walk away with her at UW Vet School. You know, I was like, oh, no, she'd look at me like, no, no. Excuse me. So, you know, that's not that uncommon. It's sort of problematic. We were talking to a caller earlier whose dog was devastated when the two of them left, you know, and they, mm-hmm. when they went on vacation, the dog didn't even eat. So you could try some of the same counter conditioning I talked about, sort of treating it as a kind of an owner-related separation anxiety.
Did that. I mean, I tried so many tricks. I mean, I let him out by the garage, and if I just walk away, you know, walk through the door, he starts, and then I just let him whine until he stops.
Mm-hmm.
But right when I come in, I mean, he's
there. All right.
Yeah.
Well, but there's a different, I mean, you have to kind of go slow on this, Patricia. And
yeah. You know, that there are many ways to try counter conditioning. And one of the tricks of it is that it seems relatively simple, but you know, God is in the details here, you know? So I don't know what you've tried. Usually it takes about 2 months, and it's a very slow process where you literally condition them to be okay with you walking just halfway towards the door, for example. You know, you could spend 4 days doing that. So you might want to revisit exactly how you did it. But, you know, it might be now, you know, this woman has worked with wolves before. I've been with wolves, but not for 20 years. So, you know wolves better than I do, but I wouldn't be surprised. There's something about wolfness that just strikes me that it wouldn't be surprising if that led to sort of a tighter bond to one particular individual than others. And so, you know, if you've tried everything, you know, then that just might be the best you can do. It sounds like the dog, the wolf, is the hybrid, is fine otherwise. So it might just, you know, you just might have to keep your ears quiet or plugged up when you come home.
Thank you very much for calling, Tammy. Appreciate your call. So many people online and so many emails here. We could go on for, 6-7 hours anyway. Let's go to Tom and Stoddard. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Sandy, and hi, Larry. I have a very unusual cat who was left at my brother's farm. His name is Howler. He's a neutered male, and he's an outdoor mouser, and he has such an unusual greeting ceremony. He, you know, likes to be petted, but he's real happy when my hand follows to his tail, and he just loves it when I hold his tail, and then he leads me around various, and sometimes I wish he'd just quit it doing that so much because it's kind of hard on my back, but he'll go and continue, and he'll rub his cheeks on the lawn furniture and so on until he finds a place that suits him, and then he lays down. He likes to have his belly rubbed and have a back massage. And one time he even did it in three different locations before this was finally finished, and the final one was he went to the edge of the road and he laid down on the gravel and put his head on the asphalt edge of the road, and he wanted to do it there. And it's just so funny. And it's just quite unusual, I thought.
Patricia, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I'd say it sounds like your dog's done a really good job.
It's a kitty, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. I meant to say that. I was just testing, Larry. I was just testing. But, you know, when you said you grab a hold of the end of the tail, that's when my brain went to dog. But so that makes more sense.
Okay.
Makes more sense now. Thank you, because now the image in my brain is a little happier. You know, this rubbing is really typical of cats. They have scent glands, as I think many of us know. They have scent glands in the sides of their faces.
Uh-huh.
And it's particularly affiliative to have a cat rub his face against you. You know, that's a very sort of socially affiliative behavior. They also have scent glands in their hindquarters, have scent glands between the pads of their paws. So a lot of cats will rub their hindquarters against you, but that's not as friendly. It's not as friendly as the head rub is. And by the way, all species of cats do this if they are social cats. And I got to tell you, watching lions do it like 5 feet away from you is really, really cool with these heads the size of ovens, you know. They're just rub against each other. And cats will also, it is also common for cats to lie down, believe it or not, and sort of expose their bellies, although most cats don't want you to pet their bellies like dogs do. Most cats don't. don't. I'm a little worried about the laying of the head down in the asphalt on the road. That was a scary image here.
Yes.
But it sounds like your cat has trained you very well to sort of follow him around. And I think that's just a great example of classic greeting behavior sort of squared with a dollop of cat trains owner thrown in.
Thanks, Tom, for calling. Pat in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. I'm so glad that you come on occasionally. We miss you on Saturdays. But I have the same dog that I've talked to you about before. She's not getting much better. Her name is Honey, the most misnamed golden retriever on earth.
Yeah, not a honey.
She is anything but sweet. No, she is sweet, but she has problems, and I can't get past her willfulness to get her to obey me when she's running wildly around the yard when, by mistake, she gets loose. I can't give her much exercise because I'm very old and she's very young. And she's in danger when she gets loose and won't come when I call her.
Sure, she is, yeah.
Is there any magic formula for getting her to obey?
Now, this is not the first time we've heard this particular question, but unfortunately, it's out there for lots of people. And we have some emails on that as well.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, would that I had a magic wand and I could sprinkle her with Larry dust, you know?
I come when I'm called.
but there, I do have a couple of ideas for you. One is you said you can't get her in a lot of exercise, but you have a young golden retriever. And one of the things that is easy to forget when we look at pictures of golden retrievers lying by the owner's feet at the fire is they're a high-energy breed. These dogs were bred to work. You know, they're hunting, retrieving dogs, and they are full of themselves. And that's the biggest problem that I actually see people with retrievers, with golden retrievers and with Labrador retrievers, is that these are dogs who are full of themselves. So here's the first thing I want you to do. Hire a dog walker. Why not? Hire a teenager, you know, hire a 21-year-old, hire a 30-year-old who needs to get out there and, you know, get themselves jogging for 4 miles a day and teach them, you know, get them the right tools so they have either a body harness that attaches in the front at the chest or a head collar, something like that, and get that dog moving. Don't hesitate to do that. It's you can advertise, talk to your vet, talk to your neighborhood. I'm always surprised at how easy it's actually been for my clients to find somebody. Usually the reaction is like, I can't find anybody. And in 2 days they have. So be optimistic. If you can't do that, seriously, I have had at least four clients. We have gotten them a used treadmill. Actually, I have a treadmill that I don't want anymore. No kidding. How funny is that? You get a treadmill. You have somebody come in and teach your dog to use a treadmill. You don't ever want to have them on it when you're not there, when you're right there. But that's another thing to do. But, you know, another thing to do is to give your dog mental exercise, which, believe it or not, tires them out more than anything. There are lots of interactive toys you can get for them. You can teach them tricks. I don't care how old you are. Your brain works fine, right? Teach your dog tricks. There's a great book, 101 Dog Tricks, out there. Kira Sundance is an author who is a commercial advertising movie dog trainer. She has great series of books out. Kira Sundance is her name. Get one of her books on dog tricks. I love them. They're really, really good. So teach your dog tricks. There's some interactive toys. Buy some of those. So that's one thing to do. So then that's going to stop some of this problem, but it's still going to happen because your dog has learned to get out there. I presume your yard is not fenced. Is that right?
No, it's huge.
Is there any chance you could fence it?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Then if there's any way you can create a kind of a double entry system, that would help tremendously. So think about the times that your dog gets out and think through really strategically and write it down, because it often leads to better thinking. Write down when it's happened and what you might be able to do to prevent it in the future. Because if she's really starved for exercise and fun, then, you know, where's her fun? You know, it's out there. The best thing you can do if it happens right now is to is to, before you have some training on her, is to get, have something in your refrigerator or your freezer, like a hunk of chicken. I mean, literally like a chicken breast, you know, like a huge mm-hmm. hunk of chicken. And you're going to throw it out there so she can sort of, don't make it a cooked chicken breast. I don't want to get her hurt. I don't want her to snatch it and eat it and get sick. So maybe just a piece of meat. I want to be careful here that she doesn't get, you know, choking on bones or something. But so you throw a piece of meat, you keep her attention, and then you sort of throw the meat closer and closer to you. And then you can get her that way, get her back. Sometimes that helps. But also get a trainer in to help you teach your dog to come when called, because that's very doable. It's not going to work from sort of beginning come training so she's out, yee-haw, free in the yard. You're a lot of steps in between there. But get a trainer to help you work through those steps, because you got step one and you've got step 50. And you need to go step by step up to step 50, which is, yee-haw, I'm finally free.
Yeah. You don't go from 1 to 50. You go 1, 2, 3,
exactly.
4, 5.
Exactly. Yes. I'm going to send Larry. Because Mueller knows how to do this, and he's a really sweet guy. And just... So take two Larrys and call me in the morning.
Thanks, Pat. Thank you for calling. Oh, boy. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, on to you. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I'm calling in response to your comment, Tricia, about the research that's recently been done regarding humans petting animals and
yes.
that causing a release of oxytocin in the human.
Yes.
And then you commented that... progressive nursing homes are looking closely at this research and are incorporating animals into their facilities and
yes.
their treatments.
Right.
And I want to express, I really feel very strongly that there's a need before this becomes a wave of popularity that... There are regulations that require any animals that live in an institutional facility with humans be washed with a shampoo or soap mm-hmm. weekly.
Yeah.
And I'm not a veterinarian, so I don't know for absolute sure, but my gut tells me that for cats, at least, I don't know about dogs, but cats are designed to clean and groom themselves, and I am virtually certain that weekly shampooing is not good for their coats or their skin, and that if we're going to be incorporating animals as therapists and part of the staff in...
Yeah, you need to follow the...
Yeah, and no, but some very, very important points are brought up here is that, first of all, the programs that I'm aware of, for example, there's a very good one going on at Naples, in Naples, Florida. These animals, first of all, they are all certified. They are carefully tested. They are carefully evaluated. The good programs are extremely aware of the potential health risks. So this is not just like sort of throwing an animal, you know, into a facility. The animals that come in, usually for animal-assisted therapy or animal-assisted activities, which are different, usually do not live there. Sometimes they do. For example, yeah. the physician who just wrote the book clearly was not concerned about the health of his nursing home patients with Oscar. But you raise some important questions. There are some health-related questions. You know, is there a possibility of zoonotic disease? Is there a possibility that somebody could be injured being scratched by a cat or bitten by a dog, you know, something like that? So the good programs are extremely careful. The dogs are always groomed beforehand. You know, there is some concern about MRSA, that antibiotic-resistant staph infection.
Yeah.
And there's some research going on right now, as a matter of fact, about how prevalent that is on the coats of pets, for example. So there are health-related issues, but I can tell you that the programs that are progressive are absolutely on top of it and are very, very thoughtful about how they handle those issues.
All right. All right. Thank you very much for calling and bringing that up. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Mark. Two St. Bernards. 6.5 and 7-year-olds, been together since puppies, recently added a Newfie, 2-year-old. They get along fine, except the Newfie likes to guard her food and not let the others feed. She's not aggressive to us, but she is
to one of the saints, St. Bernard's. We leave food available all the time. Recently separated the bowls to allow multiple feeding. This has helped, but the one saint is still scared to eat. Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, absolutely. There's something you can do. With these three little lap dogs you have, you don't want to fight between three.
No.
Two saints and a noof, right? So first of all, absolutely right. You can't leave food down anymore. You know, that works really well for some dogs, but clearly it's not working right now. I would, until you can move towards ideal, I would definitely feed the saints in one room and the newfie in another. You might want to even feed the newfie in a crate for a while, because I don't want your saint stressed and always being sort of borderline stressed about eating. So take the newfie out of the room so that the saint can eat. And the way to sort of work them back up, if you eventually want to work them back up to eating in the same room, that basically I want you to work with each dog separately so that they each learn to stay beside their own bowl. And the way you do that is with three dogs, you probably need to have at least two people in the room, but every dog gets their bowl far apart. All right, so the newfie is way away on the other side of the room, as far away as possible from St. Bernard's, and the newfie eats her food, and she's done, and so she looks up and perhaps starts to wend her way over to the saint. I want you to be there to block her, basically. Just use your body sort of like a soccer guard, just basically block her. But then somebody else is going to drop something better in her original bowl. So she's going to turn around and go like, it was empty. And now there's a piece of hamburger in it. And so you're going to do that again and again until the saints are done. So basically what you're teaching her or him, the newf, you're basically teaching the Newfoundland that dessert cometh to those who wait. So if you stay by your own food bowl, more food will come. That's really cool. And every dog basically learns that you have to stay by your own food bowl. So you might be able to get away with that by yourself, but be cautious because we don't, want a fight here. So you might want to bring in a coach to help you do that. That would be a good reason to bring a coach in. But you probably can work your way up to it. If you can't, it's okay. Just feed them separately.
Yeah. And I want to go back here. So we're almost out of time. Your blog, which has been going great, and how do people take a look at that blog and get involved?
It's at theotherendoftheleash.com. And that's just a great, fun conversation.
About everything imaginable. About dominance, I know, was discussed.
Right now we're talking about dominance and the D word, the concept formally described as dominance, and what it means in dog-dog relationships and what it means with people. But, we talk about a lot of things. I post pictures of the farm and spring a lot. There's a little four-week-old oxytocin-producing puppy picture on there right now. And then the website is just my name, patriciamcconnell.com.
PatriciaMcConnell.com, and that's where, you can get your books and all your new book, the second edition, expanded version of your book, The Puppy Primer.
And I'm going to go to Larry's Facebook page.
Yes, come to my – I tell you, there were lots of comments already in anticipation of the show today. Lots of people were interested in hearing you. Thanks, Patricia. You'll come back.
You bet. It's always a pleasure.
She will be back, Patricia McConnell, our guest, and she will be back, and we will do this all over again. PatriciaMcConnell.com, that's one place to go. You can go to theotherendoftheleash.com, too. That's another place. Tell you what, you can also come listen to me again tomorrow. I'm talking with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, about the wonderful world of wildlife in Wisconsin. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.